Honey, I blew up the business.
Welcome to the podcast, Margaret Manning, dialing in from Barbados.
Well, thank you very much for having me on the podcast, Dan. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you here. You know, I'm going to burst your bubble slightly. You are our second guest who's dialed in from Barbados.
That's very disappointing. I was hoping to be the first at something.
So I'm going to have to punch your bubble because I wish I was in bloody Barbados. It's freezing where I am. But Peter Sage, who was a fantastic interviewer. Actually, please check out that interview.
If you get
a chance. He dialed in from Barbados. Anywho, the point being, Margaret is a bit of a legend. I'm going to quote her back to herself now. She's an entrepreneur and unashamed geek.
She's
unashamed.
I'm very unashamed of being a geek. I spent many years being ashamed of being a geek. You know, you walk into a party, people say, well, what do you do? I'm an accountant and I enjoy it. And they kind of back away. I've stopped being ashamed of being a geek.
Yeah, well,
you've got to embrace it.
Embrace your geek. Well, geek is over time we've become fashionable. So that's all good.
Well, I'm hoping to become fashionable at some point.
Yeah, exactly. At some point, the cycle will turn around far enough where I'll become retro cool or something. Margaret is a digital entrepreneur par excellence. She's got a very long history of growing and selling businesses in Europe, Asia, and Australia. Particularly, she's a specialist around digital business model innovation. And she's won like all the awards you can think of, including the big one from the other female leader in our world, the Queen.
Indeed.
She got an OBE.
Luckily enough, the Queen was still doing the award ceremonies at that point in time, making my mum and dad very proud.
Well, I'm very proud of you. Margaret Manning, OBE, I should have clarified at the start of this podcast. So we've got a live one on the podcast today, and she's dialing in from Barbados, where she has parked herself. And we might get onto that because it's a really interesting story and there's some good stuff and something to bear in mind for all of us working remotely nowadays. Before we start, I'm going to remind you that this podcast is brought to you by The Tech Department, which is my company, and that's the one I blew up in 2017. But don't worry, we saved it after nearly busting it. I really don't want to do that again. So that's why I am doing this podcast, basically, is to help you, the listener, and all your friends and family not go through what I went through. So if you think that's a good thing and you want to help other people, you can help me by reviewing and subscribing and sharing it and all that good stuff. So do a good thing and help me out and help other people. So let's get into it. I'm excited because Margaret's got a long history doing entrepreneurial stuff, which means she's got a long history of things going wrong and banging her head against walls and shooting herself in the foot, which we're going to get into. And I want to start by actually going way back in time, circa 25 years back in time, when Margaret set up a company called Reading Room, which is a really interesting business, which grew to be sort of 250 staff, I believe, over three or four different offices across the world.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, she described this sort of action of setting up the company as going very much against the grain. I'm just curious, why was that against the grain?
Set up a digital business in 1996. It was against two or three grains. The first grain that it was against was, at the time, Bill Gates was saying that the internet was going to go away. So there was me setting up a digital business on the internet with everyone saying, well, it's going to go away, isn't it? In fact, a really good friend of mine, finance director of a PLC, came and helped me out and did a little business plan for me. And he said, this business is not sustainable. Don't do it. It can never make money and it will never be able to employ more than three people. Thank you very much. I ignored that one. So that was my boss at the time. I was a finance director in industry. My boss at the time said, just don't do it. This is stupid. You're being absolutely silly. But the thing that I think made to me was the against the grain was I was 36 years old, woman, two kids, setting up a business in digital. I had no experience of digital at all. Well, nobody did at the time. No experience of marketing. No experience of technology to the extent that it would there be needed. And yet I did it. So I spent probably, and still frankly do spend a lot of time being the only female in the room of digital entrepreneurs. Many, many times the only one.
Really? Even still?
Even still. Even still. I did a podcast recently on crypto, and I was the only female speaker out of eight. So it just suddenly struck me, oh my goodness, you know, this many years later, I am still the only female in the room.
Wow. So this is a kind of real moment in time then, going back to the mid-90s. Right.
It's mid-90s. It was the Wild West of the digital era. From the mid-90s to 2000, it was just the crazy dot-com boom days. It was incredible. I am so glad that we did it. It was we called it the roller coaster ride from hell.
Really? So the roller coaster ride from hell. So you've embarked. So I'm just going to get my head around this a bit. You are this captain of industry figure. Of finance director in industry, you've got a kind of proper job.
I had a very, very nice BMW as well. Company car, the works.
You had
nice,
the
cozy full, life.
The full shebang, including a company car, which happened to the Beamer. Wow, you were there. So you took yourself in your mid-30s with your family and your BMW and your nice, sort of safe, sensible career path, which I'm sure was illustrious. And then despite all very good advice, including Bill Gates's advice, you
I always listen to Bill Gates.
So you went against him and your old boss, and you chucked yourself into this roller coaster ride from hell. But I imagine at the time you I don't suppose you knew it was going to be a roller coaster ride from hell.
Pretty much. But it was one of those decisions. I'd always wanted to be an entrepreneur. My dad ran his own business, and I always really wanted to get into the entrepreneurial world. The corporate world also was becoming very stifling. And it just took a spark. And the spark was that I actually moved. I was in Gloucestershire and moved to London. And London gave me the spark it was an upheaval to do that, and it made the upheaval of moving into a completely new job, a completely new way of thinking, a totally different life. It made it possible and feasible.
So all the kind of pieces of the sort of kaleidoscope were mixed up.
Yes. I wish, looking back on things, that there would be more opportunities or more role models for women at that time when I started, to make entrepreneurialism a thing that women could do. It's still not as prevalent as it should be.
It's funny because I remember I set up my first business in 2001, so a few years after you. But even then, entrepreneurialism wasn't really a thing.
It wasn't a thing. It wasn't. No, so it definitely wasn't.
It was called setting up a small business.
Yes. And it wasn't as sexy as working for a bank.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it was like a kind of, I'm trying to remember. I remember going to Business Link, I remember at the time, the kind of advisory.
I remember Business Link. Yeah.
Yeah. And they would go, okay, this is what you do. You have to get a 5-year plan and you have to get it all structured and you have to know all this stuff. And of course, we just got bored within like 5 minutes and walked out. And then, but it was all very formal. Really. And so that kind of sort of, I guess, career path wasn't even a thing, like as it is now, I guess, entrepreneurially. And so you're there at this moment with the sort of pieces of the kaleidoscope up in the air. You've been had some advice, you've ignored it, and you've gone and done it. So what was in, because in some ways, there's a sort of curious sort of insight into your character there, perhaps, of why you would continue to pursue this despite all good evidence and other things. So what was it going in? What was in your head, and perhaps what was in your heart at that moment when you had just I don't know, like first within the first 6 months, when you were committed to it, there was no going back now?
What was in my head? Right at the beginning, we didn't have very much money, had virtually no savings. So got a mortgage based on the job that I was leaving, resigned on the day that the mortgage came through, took the savings and blew it all on a weekend in New York.
Very wise.
Well, there was reason behind this. There might not seem to be reason behind this, but the reason was that savings were not going to be enough to save us if the business went bust. And if the business didn't go bust, it wouldn't matter anyway. I was also, as a chartered accountant, I am now a recovering chartered accountant, but as an accountant, if you were responsible for a business going into liquidation, you could actually lose your accountancy qualification. So it was at the time a massive, it had to work. There was absolutely no way that it could fail. It kind of gives you a bit of an impetus. Maybe not an impetus that everybody would like, but it certainly focuses the mind.
Yeah, in fact, funnily enough, I'm mentioning Peter Sage. In my interview with him, there's a little quote that comes, that's in a little apocryphal tale of that's in the book, Think and Grow Rich, this idea of burning the boats. So yes. you're on the armies on the beach and they burn the boats. There's no, you can't surrender because there's no way home. So you have to win the battle or win the war.
And that is exactly it. And I wonder now, looking back on it, was it done on purpose? I'm fairly sure it was done on purpose, even though at the time I might not have been able to put that into words. But yes, it was very deliberate.
Yeah. So your subconscious decided to really stitch yourself up so there was no reverse gear.
Yes, my subconscious often decides to stitch me up. That one worked.
Funnily enough, I can perhaps relate to that one. Yeah, yeah, but it's interesting how you've boxed yourself into this corner in some way. There's only one way forward. You've got to make this thing work. You're going to show, I guess, the world wrong. Perhaps that was I don't know whether you felt that, but I would have felt that.
Very, very definitely. The boss that gave me that advice, I was absolutely convinced I was going to show him wrong. That is very much part of an entrepreneurial character. When we went to Singapore, I was asked by a very, very great friend of mine, very smart person. He said, it's going to take you 3 years to crack the Singapore government market. I was so grateful that he said that. It took us just one day under 3 months to win our first two pieces of major business for the Singapore government. So those type of spurs, I think, are really important for entrepreneurs. We love to prove people wrong.
Yeah, there's a sort of belligerent sort of attitude. I think I know what you mean. Yeah,
it's competitive, I would say, not belligerent. Competitive.
Well, there's a sort of, I'm speaking for myself, but that idea of like going, I can sort of on one level smugly show that I was right. I don't have to say it. I can just live it, you know. So you're right. So what's happening then in this first very early days in Reading Room, when it's all, you know, you got your motivations aligned, so there's no reverse gear, you're going to prove them all wrong, you're out to happen in the Wild West. What was happening next then?
Setting up the business in the flat. We had a printer that actually at one point was sitting under the Christmas tree and eating up the tinsel. So all our contracts had tinsel all over them. And we eventually got an office when the next place to put a new starter was in the bathroom. We did have the router on the fridge. We had two techs sitting in the kitchen. And it was just enormous fun. We were making it up as we were going along, and it was just amazing fun. We had a photo shoot very early on from a magazine, and there were, I think, six of us at the time. So we went around the office and just recruited a few other people that worked for other companies. You know, we'll give you a beer if you just come and pretend to work for us while we have this photo shoot. It was those kind of really exciting days. And what's actually interesting is that's what I remember from it, is working with an amazing team. We won a pitch for Car Magazine. It was EMAP's Car Magazine. This was glam. We won the work for Car Magazine. So we went out into Camden Town, basically spent all the profits down one of the local pubs. Next day they rang up and cancelled it. That was one learning. Don't spend the profits until they're actually in the bank.
Amazing. Yeah, that's your accountancy degree.
My accountancy degree coming out. So what I remember is actually the fun and the excitement. But underlying that, there's also this really vivid memory of sitting with Simon, who is my husband and was the partner in the business, sitting in a car, just holding hands, because a client had again, it's different contract being cancelled, and realizing that if we didn't get a piece of work tomorrow, we were going to have to shut. And we just sat there in the car. We couldn't move. We were extremely lucky, and the next day the work came in. But you do have to be, I think, as an entrepreneur, you have to be resilient to those ups and downs, and not take the highs as a constant, but equally not take the lows as a constant, and picking yourself up and carrying on when it is extremely hard was probably the toughest thing in those early years.
So this is the roller coaster ride from hell that you described. So I'm curious about this roller coaster ride. I can be guilty of assuming the ups will continue forever.
Yes.
And then getting really surprised when there's a down. And then and that took me a long time to kind of perhaps get my head around that. So tell me about this roller coaster ride from hell, because so you've got, that's obviously one downtime where you're sat kind of and it's all could go wrong tomorrow. And so and you're in this Wild West environment. So it's just kind of, so you're already throwing yourself into the mix in a way that goes against the grain in multiple ways, into an environment which is itself chaotic in the sense of it's not formed, there's no rules, it's the Wild West, right? So that's compounding the going against the grain element, and the nature of entrepreneurship itself is has those ups and downs. So tell us a little bit about what were the sort of going up the roller coaster, what were the highs from that time?
Oh, I said that it was mainly the people we were working with, the team that we were working with, most of whom are still friends today. We were going to award ceremonies, standing on stage with our big statuettes. We were players in this environment because it was new. We ended up in an office in Soho, which was extremely exciting. It was the buzz of working in that environment at that point in time. For me also, and this is my recovering accountancy coming out, we were making up new ways of doing things. And I loved that. I loved being able to come up with throwing out the rule book. I had the rule book stuffed down my throat so many times in the early days, mostly by the financial community. Bless you, dears. Love you to pieces, some of you at least. But we were very lucky in the end. We ended up with some fantastic bankers that understood the environment that we were working in. We ended up with fantastic accountants, fantastic lawyers. But along the way, you get the people that decide that there is only one way of running a business, only one way of running a business. There's only one way of accounting for a business. There's only one way of doing things. And that way of doing things is in this, rule book that sits on our shoulders and pushes us down. So I thoroughly enjoyed debunking a lot of the rules that were in that book. We had to, because we were in this digital environment. It was I called it the, you know, the communications revolution. My husband said, don't say that. People think you're absolutely crazy. But it was. It was the communications revolution. People understand that now, and people understand the concepts of agile business, agile ways of working, doing things in a way that fits what you're trying to achieve, rather than just following this big red rule book.
Mm. So I like stuff like that. It's quite satisfying innovating and creating new ways of doing things. What would be your, looking back now, what would be the most satisfying rule that you broke?
Oh, there are two. In 25 years of running an agency, we never had one timesheet. So that was quite satisfying. That satisfied me, and it also satisfied most of the people that were working for us as well. Not one timesheet, ever. And the second one was we never ran budgets. So those are two very, very, very big rules that we debunked many, many years ago. And there is now a lot of business thinking around something called beyond budgeting. It's also agile business, and it's not agile as in Scrum agile, it's agile business. Just-in-time processes, for example, not only just-in-time products. If you actually think of what it is you're trying to achieve, getting under the hood and creating ways of working that are adaptive to what you are trying to achieve rather than something that you read in a management textbook.
Mm.
I was extremely lucky having my qualification in that I was able to vocalize the reasons for doing what we did. In an environment such as the digital world back in 1999, 2000, you couldn't predict what was going to come next. Doing a budget would have been ludicrous. Actually, creating a budget would have probably stopped us growing, not enabled us to grow.
Yeah, as you're talking through there, I think there's some interesting points. And I know you have a background in coding or development.
Many years ago.
I think there's this point here of, and I was going to get onto this a little bit later in the podcast, but I'm going to sort of stop on this now. I think this idea of was looking at things from first principles, looking at this sort of thing from, which is, I know you've spoken about this, if I could just tell us a little bit about your background in computer programming and what that was and what perhaps you learned from that you're perhaps applying there in terms of the agility of the business and looking at things from first principles.
Oh, very interesting question. I failed very badly at 1 year at university and got into computing because I was very bored and didn't want to take that same year over again. So I thought, right, to heck with it. I'll take a computer science course instead and start again. And I'm not entirely sure why computer science. And I loved it. Ended up sitting in a darkened room till 3 o'clock in the morning coding because I love the logic. Coding is both logic, but it's also extremely creative. And something I learnt later on during the early days of Reading Room is that we started to hire people that had a lot of music in their background. And digital communications, digital environments are extremely good or really need people that can be right and left brain. They can be creative and logical. And music is at that intersection where something is creative and logical. Now, if you look at coding, it's very easy to think it's logical. It's just on one side. It's left brain. And that's totally untrue. It can be both creative and it can be logical. And the best coders are those who can put those two things together. What I learned from coding, I was doing artificial intelligence, ended up with a thesis in artificial intelligence, and that was 1983. What I learned from that, I took into my accountancy career and realized that a lot of accountancy is logic. It's not maths. It's the logic of how businesses function. It takes a lot of understanding just what finance is and how it works. And finance and accountancy can equally be that logical and that creative. And it's those things that ended up within Reading Room, actually looking at what is the real issues that we have to deal with and how do we solve those issues both logically and creatively, and then pushing that through with our delightful bankers.
Yeah, that's really great. The mix of creativity or creative and logical. I think that is where the world is now, just the fabric of the way the world works.
It is, but I don't think we are... I don't think we're fundamentally teaching that either to our entrepreneurs or in schools or universities. You are either focused on science or arts, and bringing those things together is actually quite tough. It's a tough mental trick to pull.
No, it's interesting. My background, so I run a technology company, but I went to art school. Yes. I was going to be a fine art painter. I dropped out of art school, literally. I didn't go to my degree at Liverpool School of Art, which is a very good fine art painting school, and dropped out and did a history degree, and then ended up getting into web and digital. So my business partner is a trained chemical process engineer. So the way we come together is like logic brain and creative brain, and that's been very much the sort of DNA of what we've done. But really, yeah, there's that idea of like, conceptually thinking and imagining things, working on that as a skill.
Yes. And if you think of a lot of the ways that, for example, recruitment happens, or the tests that people give you, like the personality tests, the behavioral tests, they try and box you. And they tend to try and box you into one of those two, that they'll box you into one of those two camps very early on. And it's dangerous. It's extremely dangerous. It's something that I found by making mistakes with people in business, and who hasn't made mistakes with recruitment, that you have to find a way of encapsulating what will work without putting people in boxes and putting labels around their necks. Particularly in an environment, to be fair, in the environment we're all working in today, you can't box people and say, well, they've got 20 years worth of, C++ coding. So therefore we'll hire them. What you're really looking for is what kind of skill sets are they going to bring? What are they going to learn tomorrow?
Very, very true. We've just hired a developer actually on that basis. In the sense that we felt that he was the strongest candidate to learn what we would need tomorrow rather than having the capabilities of what we're coding today. And that adaptability and ability to learn is something that, again, I can do that. Or perhaps I've worked on that as a craft, and that helps me every day, just like absorbing information and then applying it.
Yes, one of the things that we're talking about, the roller coaster ride from hell. Part of the reason it was a roller coaster ride from hell was because you were constantly on this uphill learning curve, constantly. And within technology worlds, you are, well, social media worlds, with marketing worlds, things are moving so fast in today's environment. We've all got to be experts on the meta tomorrow, or the metaverse tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
We've got to be experts on NFTs. We've got to understand blockchain. We've got to not be scared. We've got to get rid of the fear. And that was a huge learning, very early on, that when you are looking to recruit, you need to be able to say, right, this particular role is a role that is at the forefront. So this role would need somebody that wasn't fearful.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this role might, that particular point might not be problematic, but not box people and say this person's right and this person's wrong. And over the years, we got better and better, much better at being able to hire at finding the ways and what we were looking for, and making almost a science out of what is often a big problem in business, which is the recruitment process.
Interesting. So what is the fear?
Oh, that's a home question. What is the fear?
So you said there's a fear. There's the fear. So what is that?
There's a fear of learning. There's a fear of actually. I've got a non-executive directorship at the moment, and I'm learning. And I feel that fear now because I don't understand what's going on. It's new. There's a lot of moving parts, and I have to get over my fear and say, right, you know what? Anyone would be in the same position. Anyone coming into this new role would not understand it. So I've got to be I'm going to say brave enough to go out and say, I don't understand it. You might have told me 5 times, but you know what? I still don't understand it. And that's quite tough. And there is also something else, and I have not quite, it's sometimes a little bit more difficult to define. And that is kind of a closed mindset. And we all have it, where something crops up and your mind just kind of shuts down and says, I don't want to learn this. I'm going to shy away from it. And it's that type of fear, as well as the fear of change, the speed of change. Some people enjoy it. Some people love it. Some people need it. And some people just can't deal with it. And there's no right or wrong with that. And I think I must make this, big, there is no right or wrong in any type of behavioral pattern. There's just recognition that in some environments at some points in time, there are some that are going to fit better than others.
Yeah, very true. Could you give us an example of a time when you've kind of overcome a fear, I guess, sort of to get to that kind of next level?
Yes, actually. And it was when we were trying to get overdrafts. So I'd never had to go to a big bank and say, hey, could you lend me multiple millions? And when you walk in, you just feel like you're an imposter. And it's very easy to go, okay, no, I'm not worthy. I'm too scared of this. On multiple levels, you might feel like you're not good enough. You might feel like you don't understand it enough. And when I first started looking for finance, that was one that was really hit home, that in my kind of digital environment, you only have to be 5 minutes ahead of the rest of the world to be an expert. And it was very easy to become 5 minutes ahead of the rest of the world when things were moving that quickly. But in the banking environment, that wasn't the case. You really had to do your homework to be able to get to where you needed to get to. So that was something where I had to overcome my fear and say, yes, I can do this.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you start dealing with actual grown-ups.
Yes, it's terrifying. Try to avoid it where at all possible.
Yeah, I still have that problem. But I have to go and mind my P's and Q's with the bank manager. so just sort of, I'm curious, sort of, actually, with this roller coaster ride from hell, we spoke about some of the highs and some of the stuff around that. But what, looking back, and you mentioned one example when you were sat holding hands in the car, but what's your favorite dip in the roller coaster, the corkscrew bit? Where looking back, what was your favorite downside from the roller coaster?
But believe me, there were many. one that's that, although it seemed small, was actually in the early days extremely important. My husband and I, at the time he was my husband then, we'd got married by that stage, and we were going to do a pitch, and we were having the world's biggest domestic outside in the car park and having to put the face on It's one of those things that, you know, it's so visceral that you're going to remember it. I can remember everything about standing there in that car park, just wanting to thump him. Because of course it was all his fault. And having to put the face on, I was like, pull it up. Going into that pitch and finding out that I had left the internet connection wires at home.
Beautiful.
It was a disaster. But luckily it was such a big disaster that we came out and just burst out laughing. But the emotional getting up some days and putting that smile on, the emotional trauma was quite tough. And it would have been very easy to give up, to not walk into that meeting, and you had to carry on. So that's just learning to deal with the emotional lows, and being responsible for others. So very early on, our first employee came to us and said, "Can you sign a letter? Because I'm going for a mortgage," and you think, "Oh my God, I'm responsible for this." One massive low was we were a bit bigger. It was about 2002. Had a really, really good friend, and he was leading a team. And he resigned and took 50% of the team with him. He had been a friend. They had been friends, and they had walked out. I mean, that was gut wrenching. That was so tough to deal with what felt like an enormous betrayal, as well as losing the business, of course. And over the years, because that's something you don't just get over that very quickly, but over the years, that's taught a few really, really important lessons. The first lesson to me that actually got through was that we were an entrepreneurial business employing people that we believed were similar to ourselves and were entrepreneurs. Therefore, they were going to leave at some point and set up their own businesses. That was going to happen. So instead of thinking that this is a bad thing, and starting to hire non-entrepreneurial people so they wouldn't do this, or trying to force those entrepreneurs into commercial contracts that would stop them doing this, we actually embraced it and said, okay, we're going to hire the most entrepreneurial people that we have, that we can find. We're going to make their lives as entrepreneurial. We're going to be almost a school for entrepreneurs. And we actually sold ourselves quite often on that. And we span off a substantial amount of businesses. And I love the fact that we did that. And I love the fact that many of those businesses are now still around and more successful than the parent business was. So good for them.
Yeah, it sounds, I mean, what a satisfying legacy, call it.
Not sure quite legacy, but yeah. it was actually wishing to create an environment where entrepreneurs could actually learn their trade. And we therefore made a business that kept those entrepreneurs as long as possible. We set up an office in Australia. People ask why. Well, anyone who asks why we set up an office in Australia hasn't seen the beaches over there, but it was to create, in those early days, recruitment was virtually impossible. And today, recruiting digital experts, real experts, really good digital experts, is extremely hard. Having an office in Australia was a huge part of the recruitment process. People would, we had a company flat in both London and in Australia, so people could move between the two places. And when we opened in Singapore and Thailand, exactly the same. It really helped with keeping staff, with retention, and it helped with recruitment as well.
Amazing. On the subject of beaches, I want to switch over to today. And I just want to touch on that. So you're in Barbados. How come you ended up in Barbados? I want to talk about the visa program you took advantage of and what the sort of impact mm-hmm. that's been for you and the people around you.
Yeah, so sold the business in Singapore, and the earnout period ended in June 20, which of course was right in the middle of lockdown period. And was just listening to a program, and this heard that Barbados had instigated what became the first of the digital nomad visas. They call it the welcome stamp. And you can come to Barbados, you can work remotely for a 12-month period. Barbados has now extended that to 2 years. And it was one of those opportunities, a little bit like the original reading room opportunity. You just look at it and you think, well, why not? The business has been sold. There's nothing keeping us here in Singapore any longer. Lockdown across Europe. And here's the opportunity not only to work remotely from somewhere beautiful, but also to join other nomads. And as an entrepreneur, you can often, it can be lonely. It can be a lonely place to be an entrepreneur. You go to a party and you talk to people, and most people aren't entrepreneurs, and they wouldn't understand, or they can't understand the things that you kind of go through, the ups and downs. And to come to Barbados and to be able to have a community of like-minded, risk-taking, it's a self-selecting population of entrepreneurial spirits.
Amazing. So you've dropped yourself in this very different environment with a bunch of other people like you. So what's been the impact of that?
Well, I've got about four or five different business ideas on the go at the moment. Currently, I've got a couple of advisory boards, two advisory boards, and I'm a non-exec chair. But I think at heart as well, I'm always going to have the wish to run a business. So I'm finalizing plans around two of those businesses, which will be run from Barbados. It's very, very likely that I'll end up taking residence here.
Wow. If you ever need someone to sweep the floors of your Barbados head office, I'm your man.
Well, I think this has got to be a fantastic opportunity where you hear that there's this massive resignation process. Everyone's going to resign in the next kind of 12 months. Well, why wouldn't you allow your staff? If I was running a business, I'd be coming out here, setting up some places for them to work and hiring the best techs possible by flying them to Barbados.
Well, that's a fantastic and great idea. And it's funny because we went fully remote through lockdown. So all our team are fully remote. And I was looking at your little story and I thought, hang on, why not? And exactly that, like finding good digital talent is hard. And so why not have it so that you have a, quote, lifestyle business, but the lifestyle part of it is maybe amplified.
Yeah. And it's so easy. This rule book is so ingrained in us that it's very, very easy to miss something that's totally obvious. We actually looked at taking our 15 people, I think, at the time, out on a Christmas party. So what do you do for Christmas party? Well, you go down the local, you ask them for a table for 15 people, and they tell you the price and they tell you which days you can do it. And it will cost about, when you all included, it will cost around what, depending on where it is, a few hundred per head when you take the drinks into account. And you can't take people out for a Christmas party and not buy them drinks, right? So what we did was, that's boring as rubbish. That's really, really boring. Meat and two veg down the local, very expensive drinks. So we took them all to Amsterdam. A night in Amsterdam, including going on Eurostar, Friday morning, leave the office. If they wanted to stay the second night, they could pay themselves, and most people did. Everyone chipped in for the meal, and it ended up being burgers and chips. It was cheaper. It was much, much more fun.
Well, yeah, for sure. That sounds like a great idea.
And everyone, when they joined, I mean, the people go, oh, not Amsterdam or not Paris. It ended up Paris, not Paris again. And then we said, okay, you can choose Paris or the local. It's like, yep, we'll go.
Paris or the local. I think that's going to be the title for this podcast.
Well, why not? But it's just thinking that there are different solutions. You don't have to go down to the local for a Christmas dinner. Hopefully now you've got hordes of entrepreneurs booking Eurostar to Paris.
Well, there you go. Well, there's a whole series of great T-shirts that have been produced, well, should have been produced, with one-liners from this podcast. Paris or the local is your going to be your entry to the Honey, I Blew Up the Business T-shirt quote lineup, which hasn't happened yet, but we should do. Well, I've got 60 seconds. I'm going to ask you, what advice should entrepreneurs ignore?
I've already mentioned that they need to throw away the rule book. I think what I would advise an entrepreneur is to think, does this make sense to any advice that they're given? Does this make sense to me? Or am I going to be doing it because it is the thing to do, or because I have been told that I have to do it by somebody theoretically in control? Think for yourself, is it the right thing for us to do as a business?
That's great advice, and ties in nicely for your throwing out the rule book, because don't be sort of ambiently absorbing some bugger else's rule book because they happen to be experienced, quotes unquotes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly. A great shout, because I've had some of that in my career. What a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for sharing openly.
Thank you, Dan. It was really fun. Great fun. Yeah, you made it fun.
That's the whole point of this. I want to have some fun whilst talking about your worst experiences ever. Let's have fun. Well, I really appreciate it. And where should people find you online?
On LinkedIn. Yeah. So Margaret Manning OBE on LinkedIn is the easiest way to find me.
Check her out. She's super sparky, involved in lots of stuff, loads of good stuff. Please check out Margaret. And thank you so much. And I want to thank you from everybody here. And I'll see you, everybody listening, next time too. Do you want to get the top 5 tidbits from each episode emailed to your inbox every Friday? Yes, you do. It saves you having to go through and make notes and make a note of all the books and all the ideas that are in the podcast. We go through and we choose the top 5 we like, plus put all the links into that email. So if you just go up to honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, yes, that's honeyibluewupthebusiness.com, and just enter your email address. There's a little box, just enter it in, and we will send you that information. And it saves you having to make notes and all that. That's make your life a bit easier. And of course, if you did enjoy the episode, please consider subscribing. We are trying to help people through this. So the more people that subscribe, review, rate on Apple, Google Podcasts, Spotify, the more people will see it and the more we can help. So help us help other people, other entrepreneurs like you. And before I go, I've got to say big up to my company, the tech department, the company we blew up and put back together again. They're generously supporting me on this mission through the podcast. So if you guys want to have a look at a company that can really help you improve your technology, make it better so your business gets better too, boosting your sales and your profit and a bit more sanity in your life, a little less stress, then head up to thetechdept.com, the tech department. My company, give us a look. On behalf of all of us here, thank you for listening, and I'll see you next time.